Last week, we talked about the trouble that God allowed the Israelites to have when they turned away from Him, when they started following other gods, the gods of the Canaanites and all the people that they were supposed to wipe clean so that they wouldn't be tempted and threatened with the temptation of following those other gods of these other people. And He allowed these different enemies and opposition to come in and create troubles for them that then led to them turning back to Him. And then He would raise up a judge to save them. And we saw in that discussion last week how these enemies that would pop up were really just little localized, relatively small powers, not the big major armies and that kind of thing. And it was localized. It didn't threaten all of Israel, just certain parts of it. And so God raised up judges to deal with those parts. Well, today we're going to see how one of those quote unquote small enemies turned into a major threat and turned into a major power, and then what happened as a result of that. So we're going to talk about the Philistine menace, okay? Now, to bring us into that, let's do a quick little review of the pictures from the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the conquest. And if you look at your picture from a couple of weeks ago, you start out by seeing the masses emerging from the desert, down on the bottom left. They're coming out of the desert. And Israel was coming into the promised land, but the concept here that we remember is they came to conquer. Israel came to conquer. This was the land that God had promised to give them. This is the land that God had prepared from when He created the earth for His people to be able to be a blessing to others, to be, I will bless you so you will be a blessing, and through you all the people on the earth will be blessed. They would fulfill that destiny right there at this major crossroads area called Palestine, or called Israel, or called Canaan, okay? So Israel came to conquer. And we see on the east side of the Jordan, we've got this large sword, and that reminds us of the victories over Sihon and Og that gave them then the territory to the east side of the Jordan River, all the way from the Arnon Gorge all the way up to Mount Hermon. So quite a bit of property. Then we see the two swords on the west of the Jordan that are kind of tied together, and that reminds us of the victories over Jericho and Ai and the lessons that came from that, what it means to really devote yourself and devote what you have to God. That's why those two are kind of tied together with the story of Achan and all of that. Then we have the sword down in the south of attached to five crowns. And that reminds us that the Southern Coalition was then defeated in a major battle, and then a mop-up campaign afterwards. Then we likewise have a sword at the base of the Sea of Galilee, and that's the Northern Coalition being defeated, and then a mop-up campaign after that. Then we see the figure on the rock ledge that's standing up, and now that Israel is master of Canaan, Joshua urges loyalty to the true God. And you can see the words on that. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. And then, the other thing that we saw in the picture are the red tinges on the seacoast. Okay, you've got all these red tinges, not just on the seacoast, but it's kind of scattered around. But today we're going to see that especially on the seacoast, that created a major problem for the Israelites. Because what is there at the seacoast? That's Philistia. That's the land of the Philistines. That's the people we're going to talk about today. That's the Philistine menace that poses this big problem that we're going to discuss today. Now, if you look at this, and you can look at the picture there, you can look at any other map as well, but the picture kind of, gives you a little bit of semi-to-scale kind of perspective. And from us Houstonians' perspective, how does this all fit together? Well, the distance from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River was only about 40 miles, okay? Or it is only about 40 miles. It's still there today. So about 40 miles. That's for us Houstonians from downtown Houston to the Galveston Causeway, okay? Doesn't sound like a lot of distance for us. That's because we drive in cars. But for them, that was a pretty good journey. And you've got mountains in there and all. The distance from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee, in other words, that length of the Jordan River there, is likewise right at about 40 miles. Okay, so you see we're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of miles here like we're used to here in America. But then again, we didn't have vehicular traffic back then either. The land of the Philistines, Philistia, it's about 10 miles wide. OK, Okay, so a quarter of that distance from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. So in Houston, that's less than the distance from the west side of Loop 610 to the east side of Loop 610. Okay, not very far, but that's where this land is that we're talking about. And the kingdoms that we talk about, we've mentioned this before, were city-states. It wasn't like this huge country of Canaan or like we have a huge country of America. They were city-states. Each city kind of had its own king. Now, the challenges came into play when these kings would rally together and band together and form a coalition or an alliance like they did in the south and in the north that Israel then fought against. And we're going to see today the kings of the major Philistine towns did that as well. Now let's take a look at last week's lesson and remember some of what we found then. The first thing is we saw that last week's lesson took place after Joshua died. Okay, the book of Judges, that's after the book of Joshua. Joshua dies at the end of the book of Joshua. So they were faithful to God at that time. How long did the Israelites remain faithful after Joshua died? We saw last week they did remain faithful, but only for that generation. Once that generation had died off, the people who had participated and seen God's power in the conquest, they quickly turned away from God and followed other gods because they intermixed and intermarried with the people that they were to stay ethnically separate from. We see the importance of this ethnic separation, and when they didn't keep that ethnic separation, it very quickly created a problem for them. Now, how did God handle Israel's unfaithfulness as they turned away from Him? Well, we saw that He allowed raiders to come in and punish them and create problems for them and beat them up. Okay, they were defeated and punished by these raiders that would pop up. Eventually, and sometimes that eventually would take quite a number of years, but eventually Israel would remember God and would turn back to Him and would repent and cry out for help. And as they repented and as they cried out for help, God would hear their cries. And how did He respond? He raised up judges to save them, shofets, leaders, deliverers, rescuers that would come in and save them from the problem at hand. And then the people were faithful. Did they have a lasting effect, these judges? Only during the life of that judge. After the judge died, it says, they returned to evil, in fact, even greater evil than how they had been before the judge. So we saw this cycle played out, this ABC cycle that I refer to. It would start out with apostasy, the people turning away from God, rejecting God, turning to other gods. And then they would be battered, beaten up by these other peoples that God would allow to come in. They would eventually repent to God and cry out to God. Okay, the sea is cry out. And who would hear their cries and in His loving grace and mercy would send them a deliverer. That deliverer would come and emancipate them, free them from the trouble that they had. They would love God for a while, but then they would forget. They would forget and the cycle would return. They would go back to apostasy. And we see that cycle over and over again in the book of Judges. It's the exact same sin, judgment, grace cycle that we've seen so far throughout the Old Testament. It's the exact same cycle we see in our own lives. So this time of the judges gives us a good picture of what we're to watch out for in our own lives. So what did God decide as a result? Well, we saw that God decided that if they were going to continue to reject Him, He was no longer going to stand up for them, no longer going to fight their battles. And in fact, He would purposely leave these nations there in their territory, even though they were called to wipe it out. And God's intention was for them to wipe it clean to where there were no temptations and tests from other peoples, that they would be ethnically separate by being geographically separate. But He would allow those other nations to remain so that they would serve as tests to prove the faithfulness of the Israelites over the years. And we'll see that creates a big problem for the Israelites, okay, over the years. Now, we also talked a little bit about the leadership. What kind of leadership followed Joshua? Well, we saw there was none, really. There was no central government. There was no king. It said that everyone did as he saw fit, and that's where the problem lie. Now, was there really no king? No. We saw that God was king. And God was a great king. The problem didn't arise that God, because God was their king. The problem arose because they did not follow the king that they had. They did not accept God as king. That was the problem. The enemies they ran into, as I mentioned before, were small local powers, okay, not big major armies like the Egyptians. And the judges were local heroes that God raised up to deliver the Israelites from the specific problem that they were encountering at the time. So again, we have locales involved. Looking at the picture from last week, we start out and you see at the bottom right this disheveled figure, and that's representative of the enemies that Israel encountered during the time of the judges. And that figure you see is holding a stone axe, okay? Not big weapons of warfare, but that's kind of to point out that they weren't major armies and major military threats that they were dealing with. They were the local small powers of the immediate locale. You see that that figure has a ripped tunic and his axe handle is broken. Well, that's to point out that these small powers were defeated by the judges. You see that the six figures in the center here are the six major judges in the book of Judges. We saw that there are six or seven other minor judges. And each of those judges has a scrap of tunic in their hands. And that reminds us that each of the judges defeated the specific enemy that they dealt with at the time. But Israel never did defeat all of their enemies. They still had enemies at various places and times throughout the time of the judges. Now, looking at these judges from left to right, you start out with a judge with his raised arm, and that reminds us about Othniel, who delivered Israel from the Mesopotamians or the Arameans. The next one over is the judge with the sword that's got the red bow on it. That's the gift that Ehud had for Eglon, the king of Moab. So Ehud saved Israel from the Moabites. The judge with the tent spike. Well, the only female there, right, is Deborah. And Deborah defeated the Canaanites. That tent spike there remembers us about the story of how a tent spike was used by a woman to kill Sisera, the commander of the Canaanite army, to win this victory. The next one, the judge with the lamp and the trumpet. That reminds us of the psychological warfare that was used by Gideon against the Midianites to, as God raised him up, and he used 300 with people with lamps and trumpets and used that to conquer the Midianites. The next one is the judge with a manuscript, and that is Jephthah, who defeated the Ammonites after he made a rash vow. That's what the manuscript reminds us of, is that stupid promise that he made to God that he didn't need to make, that he lived to regret as well, obviously. Then the judge with the jawbone. Oh, there's so many things that judge, so much to his story. This is one of those kid Sunday school stories that you hear so much about, and that's Samson. And Samson defeated Philistines. He killed 1,000 of them with the jawbone, killed thousands of them when he died himself. Okay? So, and there we see the Philistines. You see now, there, you see some of the power that the Philistines have grown into as you read the stories of Samson. And now as we move into 1 Samuel, we start to see more and more about these Philistines and how powerful they've now gotten. So let's go back. Before we talk about the story in 1 Samuel, let's see what we can learn from the rest of the Bible about these Philistines. What else do we know about them? Well, if you turn to Genesis chapter 10, okay, Genesis 10 is the table of nations. This is after the story of Noah and the ark. We see that Noah's descendants, as they grew and spread, they basically became these countries, the nations of the world. And there's 70 nations in there listed. And let's look at some of the verses. Genesis chapter 10, verse 1, it says, "This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood." And then verse 6, we see that the sons of Ham, okay, so Ham is Noah's son, and so his sons were Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Aha, there you see Canaan. You see the Canaanites, okay? And this other one, Mitzrayim, in fact, that's the Egyptians. In fact, the Hebrew word for Egypt is Mitzrayim, okay, because it's named after him. Then verse 13, Mitraim was the father of the Ludites, Anamites, Lehabites, Naphtuhites, Pathrusites, Cashelites, from whom the Philistines came, and the Kaphtorites. So we see the Philistines here. We see that the Philistines came from the Casluhites, which are people of Crete. Okay, Crete is an island in the Mediterranean Sea. So the Philistines came from the Casluhites, which is the Cretans. Casluhite was a son of Mitraim, who was a son of Ham. So there you see where they came from. And there's a lot of talk about where the Philistines did come from, who they were. They're also called the Sea Peoples because it's understood that they didn't come from, they didn't just settle right there. They came from Crete. And if you look at one of your extra handouts, this won't be in the web handout, but it'll be in the one handout in class. On page 5, the origin of the Philistines. And if you look at that, you can see the what's understood, not only from the Bible, because the Bible really doesn't say as much about it, but from other writings elsewhere. And the Egyptians wrote about them as well. Ramses III talked about the Sea Peoples and how they came from Crete. And Crete, really, the people in Crete came from Greece. So the Philistines were descendants of early Greeks, what you see here. And so that's where they came from. We see that Philistines invaded Egypt in about 1200 BC, which is the period of the judges. And they were defeated by Ramses III, and that's where some of that comes. At that time, they migrated en masse to southern Canaan. Okay? And before that, they had a little smaller presence, so they'd already had that territory. We see them even during the time of Abraham, way back to 2100 BC. And but we see that after their defeat by Ramses III, they then went back here to the land of Philistia, that is where they kind of stayed. And so by this time, at the end of the period of the judges, there's quite a few of them there. And this is not just a little local power, right? This is a group that had an army strong enough to try to invade Egypt. Okay? So they were a strong military power. Now let's go backwards again, back to Genesis, and see some other interactions with the Philistines back then. This is with the patriarchs being the fathers of the Israelites, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And how do we see them interacting with the Philistines? Look at Genesis chapter 21, starting verse 22. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of Abimelech's forces, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you do. Now swear to me here before God, that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants. Show to me and the country where you're living as an alien the same kindness that I've shown to you. Abraham said, I swear it. And then if you jump to verse 31, it says that that place was called Beersheba because the two men swore an oath there. And then verse 34, and Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines for a long time. So here we see Abraham making a treaty with these Philistines, making a pact, making an oath that they wouldn't attack each other, and that Abraham was living in the land of the Philistines at that time, the king being Abimelech of the Philistines there that he dealt with. So there we see him way back with Abraham. And then Genesis chapter 26, we also see verse 1, there was a famine in the land besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Okay, so there we see him again. And then verse 6, Isaac stayed in Gerar. So the next generation had a lot of interaction with Philistines as well. Now, in both cases, we see that both of those guys, Abraham and Isaac, started out their time in the Philistines by telling people that their wife was really their sister. And there you have some of those stories about the lack of trust that these patriarchs had in God to protect and take care of them when they were in a foreign land like that. We saw Abraham did that twice. He did it with the Philistines here with Abimelech, but he also did it with the Egyptians when he was down in Egypt. All right. another aspect of the Philistines, we see a reference to them in Exodus 13, dealing with the Exodus, starting at verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them out on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. So we see right after the Israelites left Egypt, the straight path that would take them into the Promised Land was right along the coastline that would take them to the way of the Philistines. In other words, the road that would go into Philistia. The problem with that road is it was lined every few miles with Egyptian outposts, with places where there were Egyptian soldiers and all of that. So that could have created a problem with all these Egyptian fortresses and all that. And God said they're not ready, and if they face war, they might return to Egypt. So he purposely did not have Moses take them along the shortcut, the main highway that was the way of the Philistines that took, that went up into that area. So we see that reference there to the Philistines. Now, let's move forward then to the conquest to Joshua. And after the conquest, how much of Philistia remained untaken by the Israelites after Joshua? Joshua chapter 13, starting at verse 1. When Joshua was old and well advanced in years, Yahweh said to him, you're very old, and there's still very large areas of land to be taken over. Now this is the land that remains. All the regions of the Philistines and the Geshurites, from the Sihor River on the east of Egypt to the territory of Ekron on the north, all of it counted as Canaanite, the territory of the five Philistine rulers in Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, that of the Avites. So we see that how much of the Philistine land remained untaken? All of it. That's why when you look at the map, the picture from our study on the conquest, you've got that big stripe of red there. That whole land of the Philistia had not been taken. Now there were city-states there, just like we had seen elsewhere, but these city-states kind of banded together because they were common people. They were the sea people. They were people who had common ancestry, and so they would band together, and that's part of what gave them their strength. And we see there were five major cities there. Those are listed here, and you'll hear these cities again, over and over again. You've got Gaza, you've got Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Okay, so those five major cities, and all those cities were untaken, hadn't touched. Why did God leave those Philistines? Why did God not make sure that the Israelites conquered them and captured their lands? Judges chapter 3. These are the nations that the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites living in the Lebanon mountains from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamath. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their forefathers through Moses. So they were left. God allowed them to stay to partly to teach warfare to the Israelites so that they would have this oppression there, have this threat there, so that they would keep their military strong and be able to deal with things that would arise elsewhere, okay, from other enemies as well, because they kept their military strong and learned warfare to protect themselves. And, but the bigger reason is that whole reason why God decided to allow all the nations to remain that were there, and that was to test them, to be a test to the Israelites, to prove their faithfulness to him. So the Philistines were allowed to stay. Now we looked last week at the study of the judges, and we've seen the Philistines a little bit. What judges had any kind of connection with Philistines? Well, the very first one we see at the very beginning of that book, in Judges chapter 3 at the very end, the last verse, it says, after Ehud came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. So Shamgar, the first minor judge that we hear about. Why is he minor? Because we only have a verse on him. Everything we know about Shamgar, we see in that verse. Okay? So we don't know anything else about him, so that's why we call him a minor judge. But he himself killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. What's an ox goad? Well, it's a prod. It's a pole that they used to encourage oxes to go as they were plowing a field or whatever they were doing with the ox. So the first one we see is Shamgar. Now, if you go a little bit further back then in chapter 10, we see another one. Chapter 10, verse 7 says, God became angry with him. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. And then chapter 11, verse 32, then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. So we see at the time of Jephthah, the Philistines were a threat. So were the Ammonites. The Philistines was the nation to the left, to the west of Israel. The Ammonites was a nation to the east. They were getting sandwiched. They were caught on both sides. Jephthah, being from Gilead, okay, being from the tribe of Manasseh, the region of Gad, he focused on the Ammonites and he took care of the Ammonite problem. That still left the problem with the Philistines, so that the next judge we hear about in Judges chapter 13 is none other than who? You guessed it, Samson. Let's look at some verses. Verse 1, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. Okay, that's a long time. That's a generation. 40 years they were subdued by the Philistines. And then verse 5. This is God speaking to this childless woman, and he says, you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. So this childless woman was going to have a child, and she was to dedicate that child to God. Okay, he was going to be a Nazarite for his whole life. And his purpose in being called by God was to save Israel from the Philistines. And then go forward to chapter 15, verse 20. Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Okay, so Samson was around for 20 years. That's quite a while. And then chapter 16, verse 30, we see Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. Thus, he killed many more when he died than while he lived. So there we see Samson, and the story of Samson with the Philistines. And if you have not read the story there in Judges, I encourage you to go back and read it. We didn't have a whole lot of reading for today's class, so go back and read some of that. Next week we're having a review, so that'll give you a little time to catch up on your reading. So if you haven't read the stories in Joshua and Judges that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, do so. And first part of 1 Samuel, they're very, very interesting. Okay, a lot of stuff in there that if you haven't read through these and if you don't know the stories, you'll be surprised of some of the stories that are in the Bible here. Okay, well, that brings us up to date where we are now with the Philistines. But what about after today's lesson? Okay, let's go ahead and look ahead. And we're going to be seeing the Philistines for a little while. So let's go ahead and look ahead, since we're talking about them today, to see what other interactions the Israelites have with the Philistines. Now, in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, we see those interactions being with David and with Saul. Now, in the first 12 chapters, we'll talk, and that's today's lesson, 1 Samuel, where we'll talk about interactions with Samuel and the Israelites there. But let's talk about Saul and David. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 4 says, all of Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. So soon after he became king, the first order of business for Saul was to deal with the Philistines. And he and his son Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost of Geba, and the word spread. The Philistines heard about it, and they rallied their army together to come deal with it. Israel rallied an army around Saul to deal with the Philistines that were then going to attack. Then 1 Samuel chapter 14, starting at verse 13, we see that Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about half an acre. Okay, so Jonathan, Saul's son, and his armor bearer, those two people killed 20 Philistines in this story here. So God gave them that victory. Go forward to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 4. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath. Where's Gath? Okay, that sound familiar? That's one of those five major Philistine cities. So a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. This is the Goliath you're thinking about. Turn to verse 50 of the same chapter. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. So the whole David and Goliath story. Goliath was a Philistine. The Israelites were pitted up against the Philistines for that whole story. Move forward to chapter 27. Okay, there's lots more that I'm skipping over, but we'll read some of those as we go through our reading in coming weeks. But 1 Samuel chapter 27, verses 1 to 2, David thought to himself, one of these days I'm going to be destroyed by the hand of Saul. So the best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Okay, go to the land of his enemies. That's the greatest enemy that Israel had. And then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I'll slip out of his hand. So David and the 600 men with him left and went over to Achish, son of Maok, king of Gath. They settled in Gath with Achish, and there's stories that we're not going to read right now, but it's interesting things that David does to endear himself with the Philistines. One of the things he does, let's go to verse 6. On that day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and it belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory for 1 year and 4 months. So King David lived among the Philistines for 1 year and 1/4, or 1 year and 1/3, quite a while. Now what's also interesting is that while David and his men were there in the land of the Philistines, verse 8 it says that David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. Now from ancient times, these people had lived in the land extending to Shur in Egypt. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels, and clothes. And then he returned to Achish. When Achish asked, hey, where'd you go raiding today? David would say, against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of Jerahmeel, or against the Negev of the Kenites. He did not leave a man or woman alive to be brought to Gath, for he thought they might inform on us and say, this is what David did. And such was his practice as long as he lived in Philistine territory. Now those things that he was saying there against the Negev of Judah, of Jerahmeel, and Kenites, that's Israelites. So he's telling the king of the Philistines that he's going and raiding and killing Israelites and destroying their towns and destroying them and taking their stuff. And so as a result, in verse 12, Achish trusted David and said to himself, he's become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant forever. Okay? So kind of a little trickery on David's part, but it allowed him to stay there and gain the support of the Philistines. And we even see that he was called into battle to join the Philistines against the Israelites. I'll let you get to that story to read that later on when we get to that part. So interesting things. 1 Samuel chapter 31, starting at verse 8. The next day when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his 3 sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put Saul's armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth and fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. So here we see where the Philistines at the end of 1 Samuel killed Saul and his 3 sons and what they then did with his body and all of that to pronounce their victory and to celebrate the victory against the Israelites. But then we turn to 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him. But David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" The Lord answered, "Go, for I will surely hand the Philistines over to you." And then verse 25, "So David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer." And then chapter 8, verse 1, "As a result of all this, in the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and he took Metheg Ammah from the control of the Philistines." So we see, first you see David's response. When it was obvious that he needed to go fight the Philistines, he didn't just do it. He turned to God and said, "Should I do it? Should I go fight the Philistines?" And he looked to God for direction and guidance. Unlike the Israelites did, like when they the Gibeonites came and wanted to make this treaty with them during the time of Joshua. But David, we see that's one of the things that endeared David to God, is that he always looked to God for guidance. He always inquired of God. That's what endears God to us as well, as we look to him. There we see the Philistines over and over again. And there you see David defeated them and subdued them to where they were not a major threat to the Israelites from then on. So we have a good bit of time from the time of the judges until the time of David, through the time of Saul and Samuel, that the Philistines are a major problem for the Israelites. Okay? Now, how were they such a major problem? What major threats, what challenges did the Philistines present to Israel during the time of the judges? 1 Samuel 13, verse 5. "The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven." This is not the small little powers of the Canaanites and the Ammonites and the otherites that we've seen during the period of the judges. This is a major military power. Look at all the soldiers, more soldiers than you could count. Okay, 3,000 chariots, that's the tanks of those days, 6,000 charioteers, okay, a huge, major military force, very well-organized force with real weapons, okay, real weapons, not the little axe that we saw in our picture from last week. Going on later on, verse 19, it says, "Not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines had said otherwise, the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all of Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plowshares, mattocks, axes, and sickles sharpened. The price was 2/3 of a shekel for sharpening plowshares and mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening forks and axes and for repointing goads. So on the day of the battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or a spear in his hand. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had them." So when Saul and Jonathan, when the Israelites started to fight against the Philistines, they didn't have any weapons because the Philistines had a monopoly on the blacksmith trade. They had, remember, the Israelites had been subject to or under the control of the Philistines for 40 years. And during that time, the Philistines had eliminated all the blacksmiths from Israel. And the Israelites, who needed blacksmithing to be able to be farmers, to get their plowshares sharpened, to get blacksmithing work done, they had to go to Philistia, where there would be blacksmiths. Okay? So that put Israel at a major disadvantage. The Philistines were a very advanced civilization. In fact, one of the most advanced civilizations of the time. They kind of led the charge from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age. Very strong economy. Being on the shore, they had a very strong shipping industry. Philistia had become a major threat, a major power that threatened all of Israel. No longer just a small local enemy with small local skirmishes. This is a major threat to the entire nation of Israel. Okay? So that's what we have different than what we've seen in the book of Judges before this. Now, they start out and we start out with a battle. This is before the time of Saul. Okay, so after the time of the judges, in the first few chapters of the book of 1 Samuel, we've got the story of Samuel being raised up. Okay, so we'll skip those, but very interesting. And you've got the story of Eli and all these Sunday school stories that you've heard about. So those are there. And then in chapter 4, we see a battle between the Philistines and the Israelites at Ebenezer. How successful were the Israelites against the Philistines at Ebenezer? Now, the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel, and as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. So they lost. They lost big time. The Philistines had a huge victory, and the Israelites lost 4,000 of their fighting men. Why? Why did Israel lose? Why did Israel think that they lost? Next verses. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why? Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Let's bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the ark of the covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. Eli was the high priest, and so his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were, you know, they were responsible then for the ark. So they decided, the reason we lost is that God didn't fight for us. Well, you know what? That's true. And so they decided, the reason we, for us to win, we've got to get God in this battle, so let's go get the Ark of the Covenant, that's God's presence, and let's bring God into this battle. Well, they're a little mistaken there. The Ark of the Covenant may represent God's presence, but God is present everywhere. And we cannot manipulate God. We cannot force God to fight our battles. In fact, God doesn't fight our battles. We fight God's battles. And as long as we fight God's battles, then we will be successful. But if we're not fighting God's battles, we can't expect God to come fight our battles. And that's what's happened here. Okay? They were trying to, they brought the ark to try to get, God to fight their battle for them here. So, did that, is that why they lost? Let's look at these verses here. I've just kind of answered some of them, but we'll see what the Bible has to say. Judges chapter 3, verse 10. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, that is, upon Othniel, so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rithaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So if we take a look at how the Israelites were victorious over the Arameans during the time of Othniel, what do we find? The Spirit of the Lord came upon him. So Othniel did not decide to go have this victory and to win this victory and to bring God into it. Rather, God started this. This was God's will. And so whenever it's God's will, whenever God starts it, it's going to be successful. Okay? So God raised up the judge to lead him into victory. 1 Samuel 4, verse 1. Look at the first part of this story that we read. Now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. Do you see anywhere there where God told the Israelites to go fight the Philistines? Do you see anywhere there where Israel called to God to say, "God, should we go fight the Philistines?" No. What you see is the Israelites went out to fight the Philistines. They did it on their own accord. They did not seek the Lord. They did not, were not called by God. Okay? They just went out and did it themselves. They did it on their own. So now they've brought the Ark of God's presence into the camp to go fight with them, to bring God into the battle. What kind of effect does the presence of the ark have on the Israelites? Verse 5. When the ark of the Lord's covenant came into the camp, all of Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. Okay, they were excited. They were thrilled. God's here. God is present. God's going to fight our battle for us. We've got God. We're going to be victorious now. We don't even have to fight. We'll just sit back and watch God do it, right? So they were thrilled. Did the ark's presence have any effect on the Philistines? Verse 6. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, "What's that shouting in the Hebrew camp?" When they learned that the ark of Yahweh had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. "A god has come into the camp," they said. "We're in trouble. Nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who's going to deliver us from these mighty gods? They're the gods who struck down the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert. Be strong, Philistines, be men, or you'll be subject to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines were scared. The Philistines thought the same as the Israelites. By bringing that Ark of the Covenant into the camp and into the battle, that the Israelites now had God on, had their God on their side. And their God had been a God that had been strong enough to defeat the Egyptians. Unlike the Philistines, right? The Philistines had lost to Ramses III to when they had tried to fight the Egyptians. And so they're concerned. Their God is not as strong as the Israelites' God, and their Israelites' God is there. And so they're saying, guys, we got to fight our hearts out on this one. So did the ark have the intended effect? Verse 10. So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Oh, they not only lost the battle, but they lost big time. They lost 30,000 fighting men. They lost the ark. And they lost the next in line to the high priest. They lost the ark. What does this mean? Well, let's take a look at the picture today. And we've got four things I want to bring out at this point. Okay? So you see the picture. First thing you look is towards the back. And you see this massive army. Okay, even with the ships and all that, this massive army posed in the background, ready to go. Israel was threatened this time by a major power. No longer is it that disheveled figure that we saw in last week's lesson. This is a major military power, a major international power. You see the warriors have iron weapons. They have iron swords and spears and shields and chariots and all of that. That tells us, that reminds us that Philistia was a well-organized military power. Different than the other kind of enemies that Israel had encountered to this point. A well-organized military power. And you see the king, the gloating king and the arrogant warriors there. Okay. And where are they? They've got that, the ark there. Philistia captured Israel's most prized possession. The ark of God. The ark of the covenant with God. And so you see the Israelites in the front here. You see the one here in the bottom right center with the tears in his eyes. And that's what happened, is the Israelites were in hopeless despair. The loss of the ark brought a feeling of hopeless despair because they now believe they've lost God. They've lost God. They brought God into the battle and God has been taken. And now God is on the Philistine side and they don't have God. Hopeless despair. Okay, a very low point for Israel. Well, the ark is now in Philistine hands. What kind of effect does the ark have on the Philistines? Okay, chapter 5. After the Philistines had captured the ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then they carried the ark into Dagon's temple and set it before Dagon. Okay, Dagon was the god of the Philistines there at Ashdod, and had this temple there in Ashdod. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. Well, they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon, falling on his face before the ark of the Lord again. His head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. So here we see the Philistine god Dagon, his statue fell in homage before the ark, before God's presence, and broke apart the second time. So, you know, what better sign of the power of Yahweh over the power of this man-made god Dagon? Okay, so that was interesting. And then the next verses, starting at verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. And then other versions also say tumors and rats. If you look at your NIV footnote, it says, and rats appeared in their land, and death and destruction were throughout the city. Okay. When the men of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy upon us and upon Dagon our God. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, what are we going to do with the Ark of the God of Israel? They said, well, have the Ark of the God of Israel move to Gath. So they moved the Ark of the God of Israel. Okay, so they moved to Gath. So people in Ashdod broke out with tumors, and there were rats all over the land. So it not only affected Dagon, the statue of their god, but the people themselves were affected. And they said, this all happened because of the Ark of the Israelites' God is here. And then going on, verse 9, but after they had moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of that city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. Well, what would you think if you were from Ekron? Well, it says, as the Ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, they brought the Ark of the God of Israel around us to kill us and our people. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, send the Ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it'll kill us and our people. For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy upon it. Those who didn't die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. So we see tumors in Gath and Ekron also. Quite an impact that the presence of the Ark of the Covenant had. So the Philistines naturally wanted to get rid of it as quickly as they could, but they couldn't just get rid of it because the God of the Israelites is mad at us. So, chapter 6. When the Ark of the Lord had been in Philistine territory for 7 months, the Philistines called the priests and the diviners and said, what shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place. Okay? How do we get it back to the Israelites and appease their God? Okay? And going on, verse 3. They answered, if you return the Ark of the God of Israel, do not send it away empty, but by all means send a guilt offering to him. Then you'll be healed, and you'll know why his hand has not been lifted from you. The Philistines asked, well, what guilt offering should we send to him? They replied, 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats, according to the number of the Philistine rulers, because the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. Make models of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country, and pay honor to Israel's God. Perhaps he will lift his hand from you and your gods in your land. So they have this plan to try to appease Israel's God, because they feel that their problems are because Israel's God is mad at them for taking his covenant away from his people, his ark away from his people. So they say, we need to give these guilt offerings, and they have these 5 gold tumors, 5 gold rats that they're to send with the ark. So they send the ark, and there's more that prescribed here by the priests about, you know, 2 cows that have calved but have never been yoked, and take their calves away and pin them up. And if they go to the calves, then you know that it's not from their God. But if they go on to Israelite territory, then we know that they're going on, that Israel's God is in the middle of this. And then eventually that happens, and the ark goes into Israelite territory. And what did the people of Israel think when they saw the ark coming? Verse 13, now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley. When they looked up, they saw the ark, and they rejoiced at the sight. The cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. They rejoiced at the sight. They go, oh, wow, yay! They were thrilled. They were excited. And they immediately made a sacrifice. They made an altar at the rock. They cut up the cart for firewood and killed the cows and made a sacrifice to God. Okay. Well, the ark is there. These people have not seen it before. They're very curious. What happens when some of them curiously look into the ark? Verse 19, but God struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow that the Lord had dealt them. So again, here's some of that rigid discipline that God metes out about respecting him and worshiping him and holding him in awe and reverence. And here they casually just looked into the ark, and this ark was holy, was set apart, and didn't honor or respect the presence of God. So he punished them that way. How did the Israelites respond to this whole incident? Verse 2 of chapter 7. It was a long time, 20 years in all, that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim, and all the people of the Lord mourned and sought after the Lord. So we see the Israelites mourned about what had happened, about the devastating loss that they had at Ebenezer, the loss of the ark, and they recognized that it was all caused because of their sinfulness and their rejection of God, and they sought after the Lord. They returned to Him. Does this sound familiar? This is that same cycle we saw last week. The apostasy, the battered, and now the cry out. They cry out to God in repentance. They had lost the presence of God, but now they got it back. Okay? And so they sought after the Lord. They asked God. They cried out to God. Now, at this time, who was the judge? A guy named Samuel. Why was it significant? What was significant for the Israelites about Samuel's name? 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 20. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." Samuel means, if you look at your NIV footnote, Samuel sounds like the Hebrew for heard of God, or also kind of means asks of God. And that's what the Israelites did. They came back to God. They sought the Lord to hear Him. So what was the central lesson for the Israelites here? Verse 3. "And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, 'If you're returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then get rid of all the foreign gods of the asterisk and commit yourselves to the Lord, to Yahweh, and serve Him only. And He will then deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines.'" So he says, that's his calling. And that's the calling of the prophet, was to send people back to God, point people back to God. He said, if you're returning to God truly with your whole heart to worship Him, then worship Him and serve Him only. Get rid of all these other gods. Get rid of the Baal altars and the Asherah poles and all of that, and serve God only. So how did the Israelites respond to Samuel's calling to do that? Verse 4. "So the Israelites put away their Baals and Asherahs and served Yahweh only. Then Samuel said, 'Assemble all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with Yahweh for you.' When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and there they confessed, 'We have sinned against Yahweh.' And Samuel was leader of Israel at Mizpah." So what did they do? They followed what Samuel said to do. And they followed his lead, and they returned to God. God had raised up this deliverer of Samuel, who was going to emancipate them as they truly cried out and repented to God. And they recommitted. They fasted, they confessed their sins, and committed themselves to God. So then, when the Philistines then came to attack, while they were gathered together, the Philistines hear that the Israelites are assembled together, so hey, this is time to really wipe them out. So, had they learned the lesson about calling on God and seeking Him? Verse 7. "When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. And when the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. They said to Samuel, 'Don't stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that He may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines.' And then Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him." So yes, when they saw the threat of the Israelites, the only thing they felt they could do is call to the Lord. And they said, "Samuel, don't stop praying. Don't stop crying out to God for us. Don't stop calling God to hear our pleas and hear our prayers and to hear our cries for help that now that we've returned to Him." Okay? So, did He? Did God come and fight with the Israelites? Was God with the Israelites in the battle there at Mizpah? Verse 10. "While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, at that very time the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day, Yahweh thundered with a loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them along the way to a point below Bethkar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin. He named it Ebenezer, saying, 'Thus far the Lord helped us.'" Ebenezer, if you look at your NIV footnote, means stone of help. Stone of help. The Lord helped us. They saw that the victory was the Lord's, that God gave them that victory. And so he gave God the glory for that. So God did return after the Israelites returned back to God. All right, how did God bless Israel after they returned to him? Verse 13. So the Philistines were subdued and did not invade Israel territory again throughout Samuel's lifetime. The hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. In fact, the towns from Ekron to Gath that the Philistines had captured from Israel were restored to her. And Israel delivered the neighboring territory from the power of the Philistines. And there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. So God brought a peace. The Philistines no longer invaded Israel. Okay. The towns that the Philistines had captured were returned to Israel, and there was a time of peace. Does all this sound familiar? It's the same ABC cycle that we saw last month, or last lesson, with apostasy, battered, cry out, deliverer, emancipate, forget. So since we see that cycle, and since Samuel was their leader, their shofet, their deliverer, did that qualify Samuel as being a judge? Look at the next verses. Samuel continued as judge over Israel all the days of his life. From year to year, he went on a circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, judging Israel in all those places. But he always went back to Ramah, where his home was, and there he also judged Israel, and he built an altar there to Yahweh. So Samuel was the judge. He was considered as a judge. He continued as judge over Israel, as shofet over Israel all his life. Okay? So back to our picture here. What do they think the problem is now? Or what do they think their long-term solution is? Well, God's given them the long-term solution. But you can see this other figure in the front of our picture. He's grabbing the cloak of the other guy, and the cloak of the weeping man, and he says, hey, I got an idea. I got an answer. Okay? It's got to do with our government. So some of the people saw that their problem was they did not have a central government. And what's his vision? His vision is with this throne with a king. And their Philistine experience led them to think that they really needed to have a physical king. They needed to have a king. That was their problem. The Israelites or the Philistines have these kings. You know, we need a king to stand up and fight for us. Did they need a king? No, they already had a king, God. But they wanted a king. Why did they want a king? Next chapter, chapter 8, verse 4. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. So they wanted a leader. They wanted a central leader. And part of what did it was looking at Samuel being old. Samuel's not going to be around a lot longer, they think. You know, he's old, and his sons are definitely not leader material. And we're not going to read those verse 3. His sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So they were not good leaders. And the leaders of Israel came to Samuel and said, we want a king. Okay? You're not going to be around much longer, so we need a central leader. Verse 19. The people refused to listen to Samuel when Samuel told them, no, you don't want a king. These are all the reasons, and you can read those verses there. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. That's what they looked at the other nations and said, we need a king like everyone else, someone who's going to go out and fight our battles for us. Is that their problem? Whenever they had victories, who fought their battles for them? Was it Moses or Joshua or Samuel or one of the judges? Whenever they had a victory, it was because God was fighting for them. Their king was fighting for them. They had a king to go out and fight their battles for them. All they had to do was follow that king and obey that king and love that king and dedicate themselves to that king. But they say, no, we need a physical king. We need a king just like all the other nations have. Or did Samuel think that was a good idea? Verse 6, when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And then later on, verse 11, he says, this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He'll take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they'll run in front of his chariots. Some he'll assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he'll take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king that you've chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. So Samuel didn't think it was a good idea. He warned him against what a king would do. You know, you want a king? I don't think you really do. Think about what you're asking for. This is what a king's going to do. Well, what about God? Did God think they were wicked in asking for a king? Did he oppose appointing a king? Go back to verse 6. When they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you that they've rejected, but they've rejected me as their king. Just as they've done from the day that I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they're doing to you. Now listen to them. But warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." Okay, and then that's what Samuel then went on to tell him. So God didn't have a problem. He said, "They're just rejecting me, but I'm used to that. Okay, people have been rejecting me since I created them." So God did not oppose it. He said, "They're just being themselves by rejecting me." Then verse 21, when Samuel heard all the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to him and give him a king." Okay, so God told Samuel to give him a king. Then chapter 9, verse 15. Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I've looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me." When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." So here we see that God is involved not only in telling Samuel to give him a king, but God picks the king. God points him out. God makes Saul show up where Saul doesn't belong to see Samuel, and Samuel then anoints him as king. Okay, so God chose Saul to be the first king over Israel. Chapter 16, verse 1, the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king." So we see the next king, David, was chosen by God. Okay, God chose David to be the second king over Israel. So if God opposed having a king, we sure don't see that. In fact, we see that God supported it. God said, "They want a king, give them a king, but give them a king that I'm going to pick out for you." And God chose the kings. Well, what does that tell us today? Okay, we don't have kings, but we have presidents and prime ministers and congresses and governors and mayors and all that. Is God for or against government? Well, that was a big topic back in the days of the early church, because who was their leader? I mean, who were they subject to? They were subject to the Romans, okay? Another foreign power, kind of like the Philistines, a major power. And the Jews opposed, they hated the Romans. And so the question came up in the Christian group a lot, should we support or be against the Romans? And so Paul wrote about it and Peter wrote about it. Let's look at some of those. Paul wrote to the Romans, to the church in Rome. Okay, chapter 13 of Romans. "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do no right, but who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear from the one in authority? Well, then do what's right, and he'll commend you. For he's God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he doesn't bear the sword for nothing. He's God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So therefore, it's necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. So that's why you pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Okay, so Paul makes it very clear there that governments are in power because God puts them in power. God allows them to be in power. God establishes the governments. The leaders are God's servants, whether they recognize it or not. Another place Paul writes to Timothy in his first letter to Timothy, chapter 2. He says, I urge then, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. This is good, and it pleases God our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and to come to knowledge of the truth. So it pleases God for us to pray for our leaders. Okay? They've been put in place by God, and he wants us to pray for them. Whether we agree with our leaders, whether we agree with their policies and approaches and their tactics and all of that, we're still to pray for them. We're still to respect them and honor them and support them. Okay? Obey them. And then Peter, he gets into it as well in his first letter, chapter 2, verse 13. Submit yourselves to the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. Okay? So he says the same thing as Paul. Submit yourself to your leaders. God's put them there in their place. Okay? So, in summary of our lesson today, look again at the picture here. We've got this massive army posed in the background, and that reminds us that Israel was threatened not by one of these little minor local powers, but by a major power, Philistia. Okay? Major army. You see the warriors have iron weapons. Philistia was a well-organized military power, very powerful, different than the other enemies that Israel had encountered. The gloating king and arrogant warriors, Israel loses, and Philistia captures Israel's most prized possession, the Ark of the Covenant of God. And the figure with the tears in his eyes, the loss of the Ark created a feeling of hopeless despair as the Israelites considered that they lost God. The figure clasping the cloak of the weeping man says, hey, some saw an answer in government. And that answer we see in the cloud here, the figure of the vision of the throne with the king, is that this Philistine experience led to the concept of Israel having a king. Next week, we'll do a review on these last three lessons, but the week after that, we'll then talk about what happens when Israel gets a king. And we'll talk about the first three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. Okay, let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for today's story. We thank you for letting us see into the hearts and minds of the Israelites and how they reacted to the various things that came their way, because they brought them to themselves by rejecting you and disobeying you and turning to other gods. We see that cycle over and over again. We saw it throughout the book of Judges. We see it now here during the story of Samuel. We see it in our own lives. And we thank and praise you that you are a loving, merciful God, because we certainly deserve death as a result of our rejection of you or of our apostasy. But yet you love us so that when we return to you, you hear our cries and you bring us back to you and you give us your grace and mercy. We thank you for that. We thank you for the leaders that you've placed on before us and the godly leaders that you've given us at times that seek your will. Help us to continue to seek your will as we see in some of the examples of our stories about how people would turn to you to seek your will in what they did. And help us to do that in our daily lives as well. We thank and praise you in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, who brought us the victory above all victories. Amen.